You're listening to Inside You with Michael Rosenbaum. A pretty unique guest. I'll say unique because this guy started out as a comedian, Rob. He was very well known.
He toured with Nirvana.
Yeah, he would tour with them, but he would open with stand-up comedy for Nirvana. But he was like, you know, the Police Academy guy. He had that funny voice. Everybody knows him for a lot of those things. But now he's become an amazing director. He's worked on...
He did Call Me Lucky.
Oh, yeah.
God Bless America.
But also, he directed Jimmy Kimmel Live. He, the Chappelle Show. He directed comedy specials for Patton Oswalt. And
Mark Maron.
Yeah. I mean,
I worked on one that he did with Mark.
And a very likable guy. He talks about his relationship with Robin Williams, which I remember... you could tell, like, he still carries a lot of emotion and weight on that, and he doesn't really love to talk about it, but, you know,
Robin made him.
I didn't make anybody
do
anything.
You made him uncomfortable, you made him talk about it.
He's a fascinating human being, and just, I really felt comfortable around him. Didn't you? Didn't you feel cozy around him?
He was, even when I met him back before this show, he was a very nice guy.
Yeah. And before we get into Bobcat Goldthwaite, can you say his name?
Bobcat Goldthwaite.
I have a little bit of a lisp, so it's hard for me.
Yeah.
Also, Last Daughter of Krypton on Twitter. She did the theme song, Last Daughter of Krypton. Thank you. Here's a fan doing the rendition of Inside of You. Let's hear it.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
We're rolling.
We're rolling.
It's a very, just slide into this. It's not,
Well, it's called Inside of You.
Oh.
Maybe it should be called Slide Inside of You.
Inside of You.
Yeah, Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Oh, okay.
Howard Stern just kind of made fun of it on the air. But anytime, you know, he mentions your name, it's like,
right.
I don't care whether he's...
Did more people search out Inside of You? Yeah, well, then that's
good. They did.
That episode, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was Macaulay Culkin, and he said some things that he hadn't talked about, and so like, it got wind, and like Robin was like, so on Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum, and then Howard goes, Inside of You. Why doesn't he just call it Michael Rosenbaum? Inside of You. No, Robin, it's a double entendre. Inside of You. And she's like, well, he was Lex Luthor. I liked him. He was like, oh, yeah. Because he used to speak very nicely of me. It wasn't that he didn't like it. He was just making fun of the name.
Yeah, I don't. My name's Bobcat, so I don't think I can really make fun of any names.
Well, that's not your real name. It's Robert Francis.
Robert Francis Goldthwaite. But it's often people will say, did you change it to Goldthwaite as if that makes everything easier?
Like you just came up with that one day.
Yeah, it's so horrible. Yeah, it's so, yeah. Bob Scratch Goldfarb, I think, has been my favorite.
Bob Scratch Goldfarb?
Yeah, I had this woman said, are you Bob Scratch Goldfarb? And I was like, yes, I am. Like, it was like, how do I get out of this conversation quickly? So I said, yes, I am.
Do people fuck up your name how often? Every time?
All the time. So, I mean, that's why, like...
Let it go.
Well, the Bobcat thing has been around since I was 15 or 16.
Right, because you were at a club with a buddy and, like, you were doing the comedy.
Well, no, it's worse than that, because we were talking, Barry Crimmins, the guy I did, my friend Barry, you know, whose anniversary of him passing away is the 28th, so he's coming up.
How many years?
Just 1 year.
And he was a big comedian.
No, Barry was well known and loved amongst the comedy world and respected and kind of started the scene or had a lot to do with the scene in Boston. But Barry really kind of mentored me and my friend and all this stuff. But Barry, Tom Kenny and I, who...
Voice of SpongeBob.
SpongeBob. I've known him since I was 6 years old.
What?
Yeah.
Was he always doing fucked up voices and shit? You both were.
No, but I only had one other voice.
That's not true, is it?
Pretty much.
You just do that one voice, thing that...
Yeah. But Tommy always did voices. Like, we'd come home from school, and then he would do, you know, recreate the whole day and nail all the impressions of all the other people. That's one thing people don't know. He's an amazing mimic. He's great. He could have made a career as doing impressions. But
I think I could have done that.
Really?
I mean, that's... Yeah, I mean, I could have been like a Buddy Hackett or whatever. Is that who did he do a lot of impressions? Who did all the impressions?
Rich Little.
Rich Little, that's who I meant.
Who shows up in the documentary on the Orson Welles last film that he made or tried to make.
Right.
Do you know this doc?
No.
Oh, the Jodorowsky's Dune?
No. This is Orson Welles. And Rich Little's in the movie at one point.
In an Orson Welles movie, Rich Little.
Yeah.
And doing what?
But then he leaves. He's like, hey, man, I'm opening up for
Buddy Hackett.
Yeah. So he splits, and then he's replaced with Bogdanovich. All right. So Tom Kenny, amazing mimic our whole lives. First grade, crying nun drags me out of my own class. And I'm crying too, this fat little kid being dragged by this nun. And the nun's almost hyperventilating in tears, like going, I can't take him anymore, and leaves me in his class. And I was devastated.
Were you a bad child?
No, I was just, I was just a kid. I was a little squirrely, like all of us, I hope. I mean,
yeah, you know. Yeah, I'm squirrely. So, I'm still squirrely.
Yeah, so just, yeah, so... So Tom thought it was really cool I could make a grown nun cry, so he introduced himself at lunch. And I loved that, like, even then, my ego. Like, I was like, man, I got to help this guy. like, I saw him as, like, man, this guy needs a friend.
At that young of an age, you thought that?
Yeah, my ego was always big and then full of insecurity. But I always had this idea. It was really strange. I remember, like, same age, 6 years old, doing this tumbling routine, this little fat kid comes out, and I do like in front of the
whole
school.
You keep calling yourself a fat kid.
Well, I was, but really, yeah. And so I'm like, but I tumbled. I came out and I did like headstands and a cartwheel, and then and the whole school standing o, parents, teachers, everything. And I just remember this feeling going, yeah, this can't stop. I've got to keep this going, like the drug.
How
like,
old?
Six. I was like,
six.
This is how it should be. People should just be going nuts for me all the time.
And that is a terrible thing, isn't it?
Yeah, then I was chasing
because
that.
That's how I've been doing my whole life, is chasing that. And when it doesn't happen, you just feel so little, so small. It's true. I remember I was 9 years old, and I did the moonwalk off stage to Weird Al Yankovic Eat It.
Oh, my God.
And the crowd went mad. And I was like, whoa. And then I knew I needed to get, I always fought for attention.
Yeah, it's this buzz, man.
It was something. It was just like, wait a minute, I'm doing something that no one else is doing.
I want to keep this going. So it's funny because I did a benefit recently, and Tom Kenny was on with Eric Idle, and they were doing that song, Sit in My Face. And
Sit in My Face and tell me that you love me. And then hang on. I'll sit in your face and tell you I love you. Wouldn't it be fine if we all 69? So sit in my face, something like that, right?
Yeah, they did it, and then they broke it down and did an R&B version of it. And
how did that go?
It was awesome.
And sit on my face.
But I'm like, my ego's like, oh, I can't give it up. I can't let Tom Kenny. So I go out and do a headstand. I did the act from when I was six behind him.
Are you serious?
Oh, 100%. I was like...
And were people dying?
Yeah, they went nuts. They were like, what the hell? You know.
So you still have that feeling, even right now? Like, if you went on stage, you have to be great. You have to... You want to... Or do you get nervous? You get weirded out?
No, I think some. I mean, you don't want to bomb. I think that's a dangerous place. I have gotten to that where I'm like, you know, I like myself. So if the crowd likes me or not, it doesn't matter. Not like it doesn't matter, but I guess I do want to do well, but there's times now it's a bad place to go on stage, you know? I mean, there was a part when I was so like beyond it. Like I was very self-destructive, but I had done sets that seemed kind of impossible, you know, going out in front of 40,000 people at a stadium for a benefit and then having a good set. You're like, after that, you're like, what else is there? You know, I definitely got to that place. And then you add anger and rage. So I just kind of thought it was funny for a period to not really care, you know. This is like when I was opening for Nirvana and stuff. Like, I just kind of thought it'd be funny to. It didn't like people like go, oh, it wasn't that hard. It's like, well, you know, I just kind of, I would be like a heel some nights, you know, from wrestling and just agitate the crowd and just think it was really funny.
Really? So sure. you were that comfortable where you were like, I'm going to upset them more than I don't want to make
them
laugh.
Oh, yeah, that was fun because it'd be like, well, they're going to throw M80s at me. And, you know, one night they successfully tossed a kid out of the pit and hit me with a kid.
With a child?
Yeah, well, it was a guy. He's like, he looks at me, he's terrified.
And, oh, my God.
And he just runs off stage, like, on his back. But, yeah, so I would just do things like some nights that I had to act, about every third show would go well, but the first night, and I really say this story and I couch it in, like I don't even like saying it because, but I would probably apologize, but I hope he just never heard it. But We were in Chicago, and Moment for Nirvana, and I'm like, the tour bus pulls into town, and there's Michael Jordan had retired from basketball, and none of us know what, because the signs are like, "We still love you, Michael." Like, it had to be explained to us, like, right. "Hey, what is that?" You know. And so I go out in front of about 4,000 people, and I'm just like, "Hey, Chicago, I feel bad for Michael Jordan, but for $40 million a year, I'd shoot my own dad in the fucking head." And in Chicago,
wow.
After he just retired. And the crowd's just, it's not even boo. It's a,
what?
It's like, no, it's like, ah, like kill him, get him kind of thing. It was,
really?
It was screams.
Did you expect that reaction?
I didn't know what was going to happen. The only person I remember, actually, Kurt laughed. He was like, "I can't believe you said that." As I walked by him. But in order to get me out of the venue, they had to put like a towel over my head. And and the van came around. And my feet never hit the ground. This just big guy just picked me up and put me in the back. Because there's more people backstage at that point at the stage door waiting to beat me up versus meet the band.
Did you always have to push the envelope? And at some point where you're like, "I can't go any further"?
Yeah, I feel like that definitely with stand-up, you know, it got to the point where I'm going to go to jail, you know, because I was like setting the Tonight Show on fire and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you set the chair, the guest chair on fire on the Leno show.
Yeah, yeah. But I'd smashed up
the... And then he brought you back.
Yeah, but I'd smashed up the Arsenio Hall show way worse than
Yeah, because you just were pissed that they were canceling it.
Well, I just thought it was funny. Like, he's got to do his last week of shows even though he's canceled. So I spray-painted Paramount Sucks on the backdrop and then just started throwing out everything.
And they charged you money for that.
The Tonight Show charged me. And Arsenio's show actually had a case. I mean, I did damage a lot of stuff. I put my Doc Martens. I smashed this monitor. You can see it on YouTube. And then I put my Doc Martens through the back of him. So it was like an expensive
Were you
monitor.
Really angry at these moments, or were you just kind of putting it on?
I think people think I was angry at the situations, but it was more it was my ego. I felt I would go on these shows, I would do well, and then as a comedian you're like going, "Well, where's mine?" You know? So here I am on stage and I'm bashing everybody and it's popular. But the downside is one, I can't enjoy my life. I can't, you know, I'm miserable. Like, I made a decision at one point saying, "I'm going to stop celebrity bashing. I'm going to stop doing that kind of stuff because I just can't live with it anymore. I don't, even though the audience is like it, I have to live with myself."
When did you stop that?
I don't know when that decision was, but it was, you know, maybe 20 years ago.
And who was the one guy you always went after?
Well, I just go after everybody because, like, I'm going after people's calling them a sellout, and then I'm doing Police Academy, you know. so that's the corner you paint yourself into, you know. So I just kind of at that point I just started telling stories, and then I directed the Kimmel Show for 3 years. Yeah. And when I went back and did stand up, I was like I thought I hated the, you know, doing the wacky morning shows, you know, taint and teabag in the morning, you know, and you have to get up super early and do that stuff, and it's brutal. And then I thought it was the clubs or the owners or the features or the audience. And I just realized what I hated was this persona that I was doing. So I kind of had I remember the night I was in Nashville and like I jettisoned the character and went on stage and I told stories and I did okay, but it was funny because people were yelling, you know, "Do the voice," you know, during this.
Did that piss you off?
No, I mean, I got it. You know, I felt I kind of owed it to him, but I needed.
But you didn't give it to him.
No, because I owed it to myself because I was not, I had to get out of that.
And when's the last time you did that voice?
Well, I do it for like children and sick people. Before that,
Rob's incredibly sick right now.
Yeah, before
he's
that,
he's got explosive diarrhea as we speak.
Before that, it was like when I was, you know, trying to hitting on women.
Wait a minute, you would go up to a woman with that voice?
No, it'd be like, can you do the voice? Like, and then do it.
Because you knew you're gonna get laid if you did.
Well, I was hoping, you know,
and sometimes it worked.
Well, yes. That's insane.
I asked Henry Winkler, like, "Did you ever put on like the Fonz jacket? Did a girl ever ask you if you're hooking up or give her the thumbs up?"
Yeah. Hey.
He's like, "Well, Michael, it might have happened. I don't. He didn't want to be. He's this classy guy, but he didn't want to go. You know. But like, So did you
sit on it?
Sit on it, yeah.
Correctamundo.
I forgot about the sit on it. That was the catcher. Sit on it.
So all these problems I can file under, as my ex-wife would say, my diamond shoes are too tight. That was a great expression she'd say. Like, you know, you're complaining about stuff.
Yeah,
she's
yeah.
like, oh, your diamond shoes are too tight.
Did anyone ever try to beat you up from talking about them?
Yeah, people would get mad.
Hey, Bobcat, you fucking idiot. Fuck you.
Like running into someone. No, it would be like, because we're all wimps, you know, like.
Are you a tough guy?
No.
You're not?
So it was like years ago, I did a bit on Stallone, you know.
I love doing bits on Stallone.
But yeah. I was just talking about how he was, you know, he was a draft dodger and then he made a few billion dollars on this war he didn't go to in Rambo. So I said that on HBO. And I remember my daughter was born and I was on the phone with, you know, Robin Williams is my pal. And I'm on the phone with him and I'm like, I don't know if should I cut this out? And he's like, oh, no. It's fine. Go ahead. Use it. You know, I've done Stallone for years, you know. And
that's such a good Robin, so, of course.
But I wouldn't do it. Although he hated people doing impressions of him, he'd be like, I don't really go, ha-ha, ha-ha. Right? I go, no, you don't. That's you just don't something. Because he didn't, but I go, you laugh hard, but so he says, keep it in the bit. My daughter's born. I'm on a payphone, you know, and then I go back to my daughter and stuff. But I didn't cut it out, and then it aired, and then Stallone was calling everywhere I went. And this is back when, you know, no cell phones, so people.
Hey,
would
say, how you doing,
man? No, I get these messages. Like I would go into like my manager's office. And there's a pink slip. It said Sylvester Stallone called. We'll call you back.
Are you serious?
But I did listen to the conversation because my manager finally took the call. He's like, oh, I'll rip that no talent. He kept saying no talent was his thing.
No talent, piece of
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, he was gonna rip my heart out. So that's not really a death threat if someone
that's
had
pretty awesome. Awesome though.
Yeah, but then I run into him.
That is cool.
No, I just we just turned around and we're just square looking at each other and I go, hey, how you doing? and he walked away.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, I mean that's the thing. And then like I ran into his brother who I heard was upset.
Frank.
Yeah, but I really meant this. Like I saw his brother and I was like, man, I love you so much in Barfly, which I really do. And I didn't do it as like, well, I'm going to say something now, you know. And then we just talked. He got along with the guy, you know.
Right.
So it was a lot of BS. People would be mad. These feuds, they're lucrative, you know. People like it. I remember saying Axl Rose and One in a Million, you know, because it had a lyric.
Immigrants.
Racist. Well, it's like immigrants and faggots, you come to this country and think you can do as you please and spread disease. And I said, well, it should say, warning, this album contains reactionary bullshit to cause controversy and sell a million more records. And then Axl Rose says, fuck Mr. Bobcat, go play. Why is he talking about me? You know, and it's just ridiculous. You know?
I always wonder about that song. And I always like, he couldn't have been being racist, or is he speaking from what he thinks the less educated, ignorant people of the world are saying in that song?
I mean,
song.
You would hope, but I mean, I don't.
I just never understood that in One in a Million.
And when you criticize someone's context, I defend freedom of speech and people should be able to say stuff, you know, and he may have been writing as a character, but it was misinterpreted as that. And I thought my job taking people to task, but, you know, again, you paint yourself in a corner. And again, I wasn't even attacking him. I was actually really, my point was to bring it out to people who were misinterpreting it and seeing it as an anthem that for intolerance. But, you know, do I have a beef? You know, I don't know. I remember I was at the, I don't know if I should tell this story because
come on.
No, it's not about me, but it's just kind of something that I always feel like someone who's gone, I can't, shouldn't say their stories. But it was Axl Rose and Elton John did a duet on two pianos. And
what song?
I think it's November Rain, right? That's the big piano song. And Kurt spit on the keyboard, thinking it's funny that Axl would have to deal with Kurt Cobain, that he'd have to, you know, and it was actually Elton John's. Kurt felt so bad.
So he's Kurt like, Cobain spit on the wrong piano.
Yeah, and he's like, I really like Elton John. I feel so bad.
Oh, my God.
I feel so bad. I don't know what to do.
What was it like? I mean, people ask you this all the time, but it's like, and you keep saying Kurt Cobain is obviously one of the biggest legends of all time. I mean, Were you guys really tight?
I mean,
He asked you. He loved your comedy. He wanted you to do his tour. Yeah.
Well, I met him before they broke at a college radio station in Arbor, and he interviewed me on this radio station, and I remember they.
Do they have a tape of that?
I'm sure someone does, but I ran into the guy whose radio show it normally was or something, and he's like an agent now, and it's just so weird. He's like, "Yeah, I remember that. That was weird." You know? And I was just like, "Wow!" So it really just digressed to us bashing the Grateful Dead. That's the only thing I remember. But
do you not like the Grateful Dead?
I don't dislike them, but as a kid who was like punk rock, you know, that was the thing. You know, it's just like, and let's just say I've never gone trucking with a doodah man.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
You loved the Pixies, though, didn't you?
Yeah, but here's the thing.
It's Cobain loved them, right?
Well, so as far as Kurt and my relationship, he liked my stand-up, gave me a copy of Bleach. I put it in. I remember saying in the rental car to my friend Tony B, I was like, these guys are really good. Rock sucks because you're never going to hear from them. And then probably a year later, they exploded and I was opening for them. But we weren't BFFs. You know, that tour was a chance for he and I to spend time, a lot of time together. We did talk a lot and would be up all night. So I got to know him.
Was it deep?
I don't know. I mean, it was just talking ideas, you know? It was just a friendship. And then, like, different things. He used to come to see my stand-up and stuff and take people to come out. So that was the friendship. But was it like, do we...
Sounds like good friends.
I guess it is. I mean, but it's not like we barbecued or stuff and stuff. It's not like Robin, who truly was like my best friend, you know? And it's like, I didn't have anyone I talked to more. I didn't talk to anyone more than Robin. And I have a lot of really good friends like Tom Kenny and my friend Tony and stuff. But it's, so that's the big difference, you know?
I mean, arguably, like, you know, Robin Williams is one of the funniest, one of the greatest actors, entertainers of all time.
Yeah.
You know? And I grew up with that. And it's...
I just had this really weird Zelig-like thing where I, you know, showed up and... were friends with some of these people, but I didn't really think of it as... I mean, I know Rob and I were friends for 30-some years, and I always, you know, I've kind of avoided everything in regards to Robin, you know, and I don't begrudge people making documentaries or writing books and all that stuff. I just, you know, it's just like...
Personal?
Well, it's because that's why we were friends, you know? That's why, because we had these conversations that were private. And very little am I going to be able to say that's going to be educational or change anyone's love of the man.
Sure.
About his Lewy body dementia, which was a... you know, this disease he had that was misdiagnosed as Parkinson's, and Lewy body dementia is a very aggressive. So Robin was taking care of himself, you know, and people around him who love him were seeing him. But you know, we just didn't know he was battling this thing.
He kept it all secret.
Yeah, he thought it was Parkinson's, and he got really mad when I had another buddy who has Parkinson's reach out to him. I said, "Hey, is it okay?" And he's like,
no.
Because his brain wasn't working. Like, he forgot that he and I had a conversation about this. So he was not processing reality. So those last moments of his life, in my mind, was just more bad information because he really was not processing reality correctly. And, you know, that's the thing about when someone takes their own life, I think people need to, kind people will say, "Hey, if you're ever feeling bad, you need to reach out." But that's not the truth. He was reaching out. we just don't know. We don't, and that's a kind thing, you know. Hey, don't, you're never alone. You can reach out. That's true. But the reality of when someone takes their own life is, you just don't know what people are going through.
Well, there's nothing that infuriates me more than when someone says, "Oh, this person was selfish,"
or a coward.
Because I deal with some depression. I deal with some things. I've had mental issues with my family and manic depressive, you know. And, and this show is a show that we talk about this. Right. Like, you know, Kristen Bell talked about her depression and anxiety. Jennifer Love Hewitt didn't like herself. She was crying. When someone says, you don't know what's going through someone's mind, how they think, what they're doing. You just cannot fucking know the pain they're in.
Not even the pain. I mean, the pain, of course, but also the fact that they just might be misinterpreting things incorrectly.
Right.
Without this disease, I know Robin wouldn't have passed away. You know, and my frustration comes from, did he have depression? Yeah. Did he win? Yes. He battled it for years. He won. You know, it's because he's drinking and drugging. He's like, no, he was sober. He'd spent most of his adult life sober. He liked to perpetuate this kind of drug crazy thing. But the reality of it is, that's not the truth. Because to me, it's like people, you know, did he ever talk to you about suicide? I'm like, we're comedians. We talked about it for 33 years. You know, sometimes we talk about other stuff. You know, congratulations, you got an Oscar.
Back to suicide.
Yeah, oh, thank you. I go, how would you do it? I don't know, maybe a car. You know, so he won that battle. He won the drugs and alcohol battle. He won the depression battle. This was another thing. I'll ask if people, in regards to anyone that they lose or stuff, just try to practice a little kindness, you know, and because of what you said, we don't know what was going on, nobody wants to do that. But I have my own depression, so I go, I hope I would reach out when I feel bottomless. You know, I've spent many, many years where that's how I would go to bed. I would just like think about killing myself, knowing that I wasn't going to, but I found it relaxing.
You know, have you ever thought about killing yourself, Rob?
During this interview a couple
times. During this interview a few times?
God, this Goldthwait's a windbag.
I've definitely had those moments where I'm like, I'm in pain. No one can understand the pain I'm in right now. I just don't fucking... There's those moments and they're ephemeral. Maybe that's right, wrong word, I don't know. But, you know, I just feel like, thank God, I get out of those quickly. And those people that can't get out of that mindset, it's like a different story. But
also, you get to a point where you say, I know I'll be happy again, but I don't even want that. The ride is too exhausting.
You've been there.
Sure.
Yeah. Have you dealt with that your whole life, depression?
I did, but I don't think it was diagnosed, you know? But it's also, it's the depression, it's the self-loathing that's so monstrous, you know? Ugh. I don't know if people in our business are a little more prone to self-loathing, you know, hey, look at me. I don't know, but it's pretty big, you know. I think we mask it a lot. Hey, how are you? Hey,
yeah. Like everybody thinks I have my life is so together. I show up to a party and like, he's the life of the party. God, that Rosenbaum. He's so fun. He comes in there and he does his Rodney Dangerfield and everybody's on the floor and then he goes home and wants to fucking die. But I mean, it's true. Like we put on a persona because you don't want to show up to a party going, hey, I just feel like shit. I want to hate myself. Like, let's not invite him again.
Yeah.
You know, so you do put on something and then I have to come home and sleep by myself and, you know,
and
I have a Sleep Number bed, so that's comfortable.
That's not bad. Yeah. And you have your puppets.
Yeah. I have my puppets around the house and my figures. You know, Kevin Nealon came in here and goes, you need help. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, no, well, not in a needy way. He said, I think I'm looking around here. You're not a hoarder.
No, but this stuff, when you were a kid, were you allowed to have toys?
I mean, I don't know how many toys I had.
There's not a lot here, but I mean, as a kid, was it?
This is just one room.
Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah,
there's a lot in other rooms.
Yeah, but that's, I think it's.
Cool?
Yeah, because two reasons. Man. One, it's like, well, the biggest reason I like it is because you clearly are a fan of things.
I'm a fan.
And I think so many people in show business aren't fans.
James Gunn looks down on me. Our mutual friend.
Why?
Well, he just is like, you know, my buddy Dax Shepard, I've talked about it ad nauseum. He constantly says, why do you need an autograph? Why do you need... Because in my mind, I'm probably never going to meet them again. And they're my hero in some way, or I love their work. And it's a little piece of like it's a memory. It's yeah. like a little moment I look at, and if I ever have kids, I go, hey, you have no idea who this fucking person is. But
yeah, I just did that to Roger Daltrey, and he had a book, and he would have signed it, and
I didn't do it
because I don't know. I just
have you ever kept anything from anyone you've met that you looked up to?
No, I don't have memorabilia like that, but I do have memorabilia of other people. Do you know what I'm saying? If there's a fire, Nora, my girlfriend, yeah, I'll wake her up, and I'm sure. And I'll try to get the cats, but this shit's worth more. But the autographed Ed Wood 8x10 is okay. It's the third thing I'm grabbing on the way out.
By both the actors?
No, by Ed Wood.
Ed Wood. Oh, the original Ed Wood.
Ed Wood, yeah. Dana Gould gave it to me, and I'm like, I even in my exit route, like I put it above a door so I can grab it on the way out.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So. You know, I've ran into people who are highly successful actors and directors and creators, and I start talking about movies, you know, and then they're going, yeah, that movie's kind of corny, and I'm like, oh, it crushes me. It's like, how can you not be fans anymore? Mm-hmm. I think that's a danger when you're not fans.
Are you a big horror movie fan? Because I am.
I came really late to the game because I was very sensitive about it. It just would disturb me, gore and slash, and a bit of a snob. And then probably in my 40s, I was like, what have you been? You've been missing this whole world. And I went and I saw Halloween in a theater.
The original.
Years later, right. But I saw it and I was like, "Yeah, man, this is amazing suspense." And so, yeah, as an adult, I became a fan.
Yeah, and I think there's a misconception too, because right away I said horror and you said gore and slasher.
Well, I do like gore films too now, and
I like them too. But I'm just saying that a lot of the great ones aren't even those things.
Yeah, like Halloween is all suspense, you know.
Well, that's kind of a bit of a slasher, right?
Yeah, but it's like compared to like. There's just moments where nothing's going on and you're terrified. You know?
But I mean like The Exorcist, The Omen, The Shining, even It Follows or certain movies.
Well, I've made 7 movies as a director and writer.
Yeah.
And, you know, my movies make hundreds of dollars. I mean, people don't...
Hey, my buddy, or my DP for my movie, Bradley Stonecipher, did yours. America.
God Bless America, and he did Call Me Lucky. He's done a lot of the stuff.
Which are good movies.
Thanks.
What do you mean hundreds of dollars? People don't see them?
Yeah, but I don't mind. I joke about it. It's just me, like, when I start talking about my canon of work, you know. But I did do a suspense scary movie, Willow Creek. It's a Bigfoot movie, and I did it because I didn't know if I could scare people. And that was the whole experiment for me. Like often when I start a movie, it's like, can I do this? Can I do a rom-com with a tiny bit of bestiality in it? You know? and then I go and make that movie. Can I do like God Bless America? Can I make this movie? And can you empathize with these characters? And I would think I was working out a lot about how I saw the world. But I say that's a very violent movie about kindness, you know, and I was just truly trying to ask, where are we going as a culture? And so many of the things in that movie actually ended up happening. So I wasn't really that upset. I kind of knew that would happen in a weird way.
Right.
The violence in there.
Is that what it takes for you to make a movie, though? Do you need to just to think, I don't know if I can make this. I've never done this kind of thing before. You have to be challenged. You don't want to repeat the same kind of idea.
Yeah. It's like, oh, can I do this? You know, is this a genre or style I haven't done? And then there's always a personal thing that I never see until later on. Like my daughter would be like, yeah, that's you, dummy. I go, oh, I didn't get it.
Your dad will say that?
No, my daughter. That's happened a few times. Yeah. She goes, you don't get this. Like I did.
Your own movie?
Yeah. Like I did a series called Misfits and Monsters, and there's an episode with our buddy Seth Green. He's the voice of this beloved animated bear, Bubba the Bear, you know, hey, 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 I'm Bubba the Bear. And Bubba the Bear shows up at his front door and he's like, I'm going to fucking kill you. I'm going to send you back to hell. Why you got me stuttering? That's something funny for kids to laugh at. So he's the voice of Bubba the Bear and Bubba's trying to kill him. And it's like Cape Fear meets Roger Rabbit. And I always thought I was thinking it was based on Tom Kenny who is SpongeBob and all these things. And then it was my daughter goes, no, Dad, this is about you. You know, you can't get away from that persona you created. And it was killing you. And I was like,
how old is she?
Well, now she's 31. But yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, I was like, oh, I didn't get that.
And what was the documentary? Did you see this documentary?
Call Me Lucky?
Call Me Lucky. I haven't seen it yet.
It's about my friend Barry Crimmins, who was a political satirist. My favorite Barry joke is him getting heckled and the guy, because he's, you know, very progressive politically. And someone's like, if you don't love this country, why don't you get out of it? And he's like, because I don't want to be victimized by its foreign policies. So he's really sharp
great.
Guy.
That's
yeah.
great.
Super sharp guy. Known him since I was a kid. Like I was 15, I think, when we met. Tom Kenny and I answered this ad. They're looking for comedians. And that's where I became Bobcat, because people called him Bearcat. And Tom Kenny and I, being snarky little pricks, were like, oh, that's funny. They call me Bobcat. And he's like, yeah, they call me Tomcat. Yeah. But then like 35 years later, he's
and
Barry, he's
and
Tom, and I'm Bobcat, 15. But Barry didn't even know until recently. He was so pissed, furious at me. You snide little fucker. Like he wanted to kill me. But so Barry, as an adult, kind of starts this comedy scene or a big part of it in Boston, which you got like Kevin Meaney and Paula Poundstone and myself and Steve Sweeney and Lenny Clark, and I'm sure I'm forgetting people, Dennis Leary, Stephen Wright, did I say Stephen Wright? All these people.
I work with Stephen Wright. He's an interesting guy.
He's the best. I love Stephen.
Joanie Rafferty were known, what dual known as Steeler's Wheel when they recorded this bubblegum pop favorite, whatever that
yeah,
fucking
yeah,
was
yeah.
from Reservoir Dogs.
Well, Stephen won an Oscar for his short, and he went up and he's like, I'm really glad I cut the other 45 minutes out. So I haven't seen Stephen a lot. Lately, that's my thing. I've been really connecting with old friends on purpose.
Why?
Just because you just talk a lot of shit. Hey, let's get together. Boy, we had fun. And now I actually do it. Like I buy a ticket. I fly across the country.
Doesn't that take a lot of your time?
It doesn't matter.
It's meaningful.
Also just like, oh, do you remember that day you worked on that script all day? Or do you remember that time you surprised Tony on his 65th birthday? You know, which am I going to remember? You know?
Yeah.
So my friend Jack is performing with a band Saturday. I'm going to fly up to Sacramento for the night. I don't care anymore. You just do it.
You make the time.
You just do it. Yeah. I mean, that's it. That's the whole deal. When someone passes away, you show up. That's the other thing, too. It's like, oh, I didn't know that, you know? I'm becoming like the fixer, or the cleaner in Pulp Fiction. I show up, my friend passes away, and I walk in. I go, all right, get off the phone. No one needs to talk to the press. Order half the amount of food you just said you were going to get, and get some booze here for the grown-ups.
Really?
This is how we do it.
You step up.
Yeah, I'm not.
You're not a crier. You're not that emotional, or you do it by yourself.
I guess I do that kind of stuff by myself, but I had people that stepped up for me when I lost people. So it's just what you do.
Who had to step up for you?
Well, like when my dad died, Barry just showed up. I hadn't even told him. I don't even know how he knew it. He just shows up in Syracuse at the funeral, and here's this guy, this renowned political satirist, and he didn't like crotch humor or fart humor, all that kind of stuff.
You
and,
did, right?
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
And so he's telling me, trying to steer me away from that for 40 years. And then he shows up at my dad's funeral with an electronic fart machine in his pocket.
Oh my
you
God.
Know? Yeah, so that's what you do. So Barry, as a political satirist, he's having success somewhat as a guy running a club. And then one night he discloses on stage talking about his rape when he was 4.
This is Call Me Lucky.
Yeah, Call Me Lucky. And so that just sent him on this thing like looking for other survivors. Who is he? What's he going to do? Barry was always angry my whole life. Just one of the more angrier people. So Barry goes and while he's looking for other survivors, this is the early days of AOL. He finds all this child pornography. He goes to the feds. They don't do anything. Goes to the police. They don't do anything. Then he goes to AOL. No one was listening to him because it was a new thing, too. And so he posed as 2 kids, got all this crime evidence. That's what child pornography is, handed it over to the feds, and then a whole bunch of arrests were made. But he ended up on the floor of the Senate taking on AOL in a real Frank Capra kind of moment. And then other things happened. But you see,
wow.
at the end of Barry's life was, not the end of his life, but the next chapter of his life, he shifted that rage that was at where he's angry at everybody, and then he starts using it like a laser beam on targets and things and people. But and meanwhile, too, I don't want to. You know, he's also still very funny and very silly.
Yeah.
You
know? And where can we find this?
I think at this point, I don't know. I think it's like on iTunes only. It was on Netflix for a while, but then they pull stuff off.
What's the project you're most proud of that you've worked on that you're like?
I think it's like Call Me Lucky, and I think World's Greatest Dad, the movie I did with Robin. I like those movies. I like them all for different reasons, but those are the two where I felt.
You had the most fun?
No, it was the two where I think I kind of came closest to what I was trying to do. I've done smaller movies where I have a lot of fun. You know, when you're doing a movie about child rape, it's a hard movie. And Barry go, oh, I'm sorry, it was hard for you. Because there's a scene, I go, I didn't want to do reenactments doing a Q&A. And Barry goes, you didn't want to do reenactments. So it was really dark, but I found we did laugh a lot. But because we were listening to other survivors' stories and engaging with these people. So it was about as heavy as it was going to be for him.
Is it sometimes hard for you to deal with such heavy stuff?
Yeah, and especially if you're connected with the person. You know, the hardest direction I've ever given in my life was Barry on camera disclosed the events. And it was like 10 o'clock in the morning. I went to the refrigerator and I opened up a beer for him and he drinks a beer. And then I came in and I go, I think we're both making this movie for the same reason. I need you to not tell the story. I need you to think about what happened and tell me those events.
How hard is that for you to say?
It was hard. And then he did it. And that's what's in the movie. But that's the hardest bit of direction I think I've ever.
To say, hey, listen, there's a difference between, hey, tell us what happened.
Yeah. Or relive it.
Relive it.
And that's what's in the movie.
Yeah. It's amazing when you stop for a second and you actually think of what you're talking about sometimes.
Yeah.
I was just the other day, somebody asked me about something just not even that important. But I thought of my brother saying it to me. And it just, I teared up.
Yeah.
And I just was like, oh my, because I visualized my brother looking at me with such like, I don't know, this kind face, this brother that I've, you know, I love him, but that visual changed me. It was an emotional moment. So it's amazing when you do think about what you're talking about, if it's impactful, how it could really just.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's a selfish thing, me asking him to go to those depths. But I think because of my friendship and relationship, I could ask him that.
And not only that, but if he does it, it is helping other
people.
Well,
that's the thing when we made the movie. Like, I was making the movie because I knew Barry's story was amazing. I love my friend and I wanted the world to know him. The byproduct, which I didn't expect, was the amount of people. Like at screening, so many people come up and disclose for the first time about their own abuse, and they're just crying and hugging you. And it was.
Does that make you uncomfortable, or do you like that?
No, I was very uncomfortable.
Because it's got to be overwhelming when it's just like, okay.
Yeah. So the movie now being done, I'm doing it as a narrative film, which I actually originally was going to do. I was going to do it with Robin as a narrative movie.
Right.
Robin says, you're never going to make that movie. We're all getting old. Do it as a doc. I go, I don't have any money. He's like, here's some money. Go start the movie. So that's how the movie got made.
Wow.
So Robin encouraged me to go make this movie. So then we make the movie. And then I got divorced at the beginning of the year. And then Robin killed himself. And then I'm editing a baby rape documentary 10 hours a day. And then my girlfriend and I split up decorating the Christmas tree.
What happened there? Out of all the things you just said, I want to know about the Christmas tree.
Well, but
how do you break up while decorating a Christmas tree?
I understand what happened. I think and she's a great person. She looked down in that tree and I'm assuming she realized that there was never going to be kids at the bottom of the tree. I think that's what fueled that.
Was it a fight?
No. It was really harsh.
I could just hear like Bing Crosby and then I can't do this.
And I do love her. She's a great person. But I was like, what happened was, so I had this half decorated tree. And then one morning I was like, fuck you, tree. I'm better than you. I put on some Peggy Lee and I put on some Joy Division.
Oh yeah.
And then I finished that tree.
Love will tear us apart. Yeah. Again. And then that song?
Yeah, of course. And then I finished the tree. I was like, I did it.
Do you get over shit quickly?
No. I mean, that's why, like I said to my friend who just this other fellow who I'd worked with and I did know, and he was a really good guy, Kevin Barnett. He passed away, but I went to his two closest friends, Josh and Jermaine, and I was like, you know, when this happens, you kind of feel like you're not allowed to live your life because you're forgetting this person, because these guys were so close to him. Like, if I laugh, I feel like I'm betraying Robin. If I continue my life, I feel like I'm betraying him, but I'm not. He would want me to.
Of course.
And it's hard. It's easier if it's not someone who takes their own life, but when someone dies, it's an arm and that's missing, and that, and it is in a way, but you will experience joy again.
That's I think that comes from experience, and that comes from just living and hitting rock bottom. So many times that you're like going, I mean, what's the alternative?
When someone dies, you think, well, I'm going to do this. You know, we're going to have a memorial, and that'll help. And it won't. Or it does for some in some ways, but it doesn't. Or I'm going to go on a trip and go to a beach, and that doesn't do it. I think time is the thing, you know?
Do you ugly cry? Do you go home by yourself and cry like no one's ever seen a person cry?
No, you know, it's funny. I well up at a commercial, but then those big blowout cries, it's been a long time.
What's the last time you had one of those?
I think it was when Robin passed away, but it was weird because it didn't come at all when people expected it to.
What about success?
I was on a plane.
Wait, you were on a plane when you found out? And you had
No. I'd found out and everything, but the big ugly cry came when I was on a plane. Robin had the worst taste in music. He really just like, all apologies to anybody.
I love it. I bet it's like cheesy music.
No, but it's just like, just anything. Like for some reason, that wasn't something he was passionate about. Strange. So in World's Greatest Dad, the song Under Pressure is used in a couple ways. It's used comedically and then it's used at the end of the film. And he loved it and he's like, I'm gonna make that my song. You know, like, he wanted that song when people play, when he walked onto a talk show. He wanted
Under
that.
Under Pressure.
He wanted that, but no way people are gonna play Rockin' Robin or, you know,
right.
Some bullshit from Aladdin or something. So, and I just put on my headset and that song came on and then I just lost my mind. I just, on a plane, I just like.
Were people, was someone next to you?
I don't know what they were making. I just buried my face in the window and I just lost sobbed it. And sobbed, yeah. Yeah, but it didn't come when I imagined it was going to. And that sucker punched me because I just, just put on my headset. Duh! And then I actually thought at one point I would possibly make a movie about our relationship, but not about he and I, about like two painters. One's super successful and one's painting Disney characters on kids' bedroom walls for rich people. So it was going to be him and I. And I went back and I listened to our voice messages and I thought I could, I'll just do this and then I'll start writing. And then, so that destroyed me. Like, I had about 45 pages of that script and then I listened to those messages and maybe someday I'll go back to it, but probably not real soon.
I like that idea though.
Yeah, I think it's good. You know, well, I'm making Call Me Lucky into a narrative, like I was saying with Judd Apatow, and I'm, you know, and so that's what the plan.
Yeah.
But part of it was trying to help Barry and Helen out, see if we can make this movie deal. So I'm visiting Barry, and he's close to death, and he drags me into the kitchen, and he can't walk very well, and he's like, I need to talk to you. And I was like, I think he's going to tell me he loves me or take care of Helen or where the money's buried. I don't know what this is like. And he's like, I want Mark Ruffalo to play me in the movie. And I was like, Barry, I don't want to talk about the movie right now. I do. I want Mark Ruffalo to play. And I was like, I want Chris Pine to play me. And he's like, who's Chris Pine? I go, how do you know Mark Ruffalo? And he's, because Barry, you know, he did watch movies. We watched old movies. I go, how do you know Mark Ruffalo? He goes, I've seen him speak at anti-fracking demonstrations. I really like the guy.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Somebody said, you know, they'll say, boy, tragedy follows you a lot. But the reality of it is that's not the case. I've just been fortunate enough to connect and have friendships with a lot of people.
Speaking of friendships, you're good friends with one of my best friends, James Gunn.
Yeah.
Now, you kind of lost your marbles a little bit when they fired him from Disney.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I just made it clear, you know.
Well, a lot of people were unhappy. Everyone was unhappy.
But I just made a statement, which is kind of funny that where I was saying that.
What was the statement?
I'll be paraphrasing myself, but I said, hey, Disney, you know, you might want to remove my voice from this upcoming attraction, seeing that I, too, have said a lot of things in the past that I regret. And
you made Song of the South.
Well, I ended a little bit on that because I said, clearly you're taking your lead from fringe right-wing radical groups. They're making decisions for you. So I've also said offensive things about the president. And so, you might want to pull my voice off of this thing. And
did they?
And I also said, no, they didn't. I also said, because James Gunn's voice was on, I go, hey, you might want to check James Gunn's, James Woods was also in this voiceover thing that I did. And I said, you might want to check James Woods' tweets. He's write some really wacky stuff too. P.S. Are you guys still making money off of powder? Asking for a friend. It blew up, you know. I just did it because I love James, and he regrets saying those things. He's saying them to be outrageous.
Yeah, it was provocateur. It was 10 years ago, and he was responding, and it wasn't.
That's not the person he is.
Not at all.
He had apologized a few times.
They knew about it before, right?
Yeah. Look, like I said, we opened this with me telling that. The Michael Jordan story. So I've said things I regret. And I also said, oh, by the way, I stand with survivors. Are you making money off of powder? But, you know, what I didn't expect was the reaction. Like that itself became a news story. But,
well, it's not a stupid question. It's important because I always want to know because I see your whole persona and how you've come full circle from doing a lot of angry comedy and going after people to saying, you know, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not doing the voice unless it gets me laid or I'm doing it for whatever. And all these, you know, these movies that push you or provocative or storytelling and something, you know, things that you don't look at as, oh, this will be a commercial success, but more things that interest you. But I look back, did you have a good childhood?
I don't think so. But what makes me laugh is everything I do, I'm kind of doing it on a selfish basis. Trying to make this movie, trying to do this, trying to do that. If it connects with people, that's awesome, and I'm hoping it does. But to reinvent myself as a director or a storyteller or make money, that's not what I'm doing. I mean, for the first movies I made, I was still on the road all the time doing stand-up so I could pay my bills so I could keep making movies. I made a living so I could make movies. I didn't make my living off of making movies. So it's only recently now I'm starting to get paid, which is crazy. But I forgot where I was going with that. Sorry.
Well, I was talking about your childhood, and I was talking about your movies
This is what I was thinking about, and what people will say, like I come and stand up for James, or I go to the Women's March, or I go to anti-Trump rallies, and people will. I'm only on Instagram. I'm not on any other social media, but they'll say, "You just lost a Fowler," and it's like, ah. I used to play arenas. I've lost millions of followers. You're really late to that. So I don't know who has a lovely childhood. I had a mother that told me I could do anything. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I had a dad who was bananas. And some of that was inspired lunacy that was kind of genius. And then other times it was frightening, you know. So... when you grow up with a lot of drinking, it's partially our house was a little bit like in the movie Mask, you know, that the yard, the sheriff's boyfriend, I think it's Sam Elliott, all the Harleys on the front yard. So my house was that house. So there's keg parties and my brother who is a biker, there was always motorcycle clubs at the house. So it was kind of chaotic. And then I go to Tom Kenny's house where his parents are college educated and his father's a successful.
And don't you think a lot of your shit,
so
the insanity, but the love at the same time from your mom is like this dichotomy of like, that you kind of brought that into your, who you, I mean, look, you're a product of your own environment, right?
Right.
It's like, do you think a lot of that angry stuff and a lot of that, you know, stems from your surroundings when you're young?
I don't know where the anger came from, because Tom Kenny and I couldn't figure this out. You know, we're in high school, we're getting 3 square meals. Our life's pretty good. And
did
we
you get in fights? No.
No, but we're so angry. We're these snotty guys who are just furious and sarcastic and cutting. Like Barry, who was one of the most sarcastic people. Not sarcastic. Yeah, I don't know. But cutting, like he was really...
cynical?
No, because he hates the word cynical, because cynicism is hopelessness, you know? But so he would say, hey, I'm still... You may not like what I'm saying, but I'm still swinging, you know, coming up to bat. You know, cynicism is when you no longer show up. To the point that Tom Kenny and I were so kind of vicious and so petty and funny when we were kids that even Barry was a little afraid of us.
Were you just judgmental?
Yes,
like,
yes.
Everybody making fun of everybody.
Yeah, everybody.
Look at this fucking guy.
Yeah, everything.
Look at this girl.
But why were, who, why? You know?
I mean, but you never looked at yourselves.
Yeah.
That's the same thing. People, it's always wearing, that case, right?
But we weren't, it's just weird. You know, and here's Tom Kenny in a trench coat with a dickie and, you know, and I'm wearing whatever I'm wearing, you know, combat boots. And, you know, we're just like idiots. So why are we, what are you looking at? Well, you.
Were you?
you look like a moron.
Were you guys clowns in school? Like, or did you get like the funniest guy? Or
yeah, we were class clowns and all that stuff. But by the time I was 16, I was just like so into doing stand-up that being popular in school kind of didn't even matter. And I was just like, well, I'm just going to do this.
Well, when did the...
I got on Letterman. I was 20. So it's pretty
20
crazy.
20 years old, you got on Letterman.
Yeah, well,
yeah. Who's every comedian's hero?
I liked Letterman. I liked his show, like when it first started, and it was really abstract how crazy it would be. You know, I mean, it was just so strange. It was really abstract. It was very Dada. Do you remember? It'd be like...
Yeah, my uncle was on it many years ago. My uncle was Warren Eckstein. He's a pet therapist, psychologist,
exactly.
Trains animals. He brought a pig on Letterman, you know, and they used to drive around in Letterman's duster.
And the woman that would like dress up parrots and
but
Brother Theodore was on, Andy Kaufman was on. They would just like
it was just offbeat. It was just like
really weird because they would just like they would the bumpers going to commercials would show the one night I remember they just had the different forms of welding, acetylene torch, and then they had a guy welding, and they would just I mean that's really abstract. So
right.
I like that.
Did he love you the first time you went on there?
Oh, you know, they had me back right away. It was just like, I'm 20 years old. They don't go, hey, this guy's 20 years old. They're like, this is one of the weirdest acts we've ever seen.
Do you remember what you said?
No. I mean,
anything?
I was just so far in the character, I'm pretty inaudible. It's just all stuttering and screaming.
So that, where did that come from?
I think I'm like doing, you know, I don't know if then, but you know, the big one would be like, my wife's so fat, you know. How fat is she? I don't have a wife. And I'd start crying and read a Dear John letter that I got. And then I go back to my act. And it's
so
it was just all tears and rage. It wasn't like I looked at somebody and said, hey, I'm going to ape that guy's persona. I was just much more comfortable being anyone but me on stage. So it would be... It was actually a guy, the first time I did it, was a guy who had seen Bigfoot and he was trembling and terrified. Yeah, it just kind of grew from there. But I'm not, like I say, like I remember when I was on Letterman, I was so terrified. I was sick, you know, trying to do well, so nervous.
Did you like throw up before you ever shit?
I
always take a lot of shits before I go up. I throw up.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what it was like. I had really gotten myself so sick physically just going.
I'm going to pass out in front of millions of people. I am fucked. I'm going to die. I'm going to have a heart attack.
But then I go, and like when my buddy Tony ends up getting on Conan, I don't go, hey, you don't worry about that. I just, you know, I send him a thing of flowers saying, don't fuck this up. You know?
Did you audition for Police Academy?
No, they saw me do this show at the Comedy Store with Whoopi, believe it or not, that many years ago. And I go out and do the show, and, you know, there's Pryor in the audience. It was just, like, crazy. Yeah, because Whoopi had all this heat, so there was this room, and the producer was there, and they had asked me to be in it. Yeah. I think if I had auditioned for it, I wouldn't have gotten it because, one, I would have been nervous, and two, they would say, I think they needed to hear people laughing at what I was doing, you know?
Right.
Like, the first screening I saw of Police Academy 2, I didn't get one laugh because the crowd was just like, what the fuck is this guy doing? And they're laughing at the rest of the movie. And then my manager at the time was like, hey, man, you got to go and come to Westwood and see the movie. Because it was that I didn't get a laugh when I saw this with the friends and family. Like, people were like,
were you like, did you feel like shit?
Yeah, I felt like I was like horrible. I was so depressed. So then I went to Westwood and it was inverted. Like, I was getting laughs and Michael Winslow was getting laughs, but the rest of the movie wasn't getting any laughs.
Really? Because you guys were characters. You were fun to watch.
I don't know, but that, you never know. Yeah, I mean, that sounds very egotistical, but that is what happened. So that's how it went.
Yeah, I've had those moments where I go in there and like I was telling this story, Dax. I did this movie, and Dax, my buddy Dax, texted me in the theater and said, "This movie's so bad, I can't believe I'm not in it."
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, God, I know. Fuck. What do I do, man? Yeah. Well, you can't do anything. We do a lot of bad movies.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, you know, your goal is to work. I mean, there are people that turn down stuff, but then they don't pay the bills. You know, I was on the way to a set one day. I remember being in a van on the set, being driven to do a scene in Police Academy, and I didn't know where to stand. I didn't know anything. And then I was in a van recently. I was directing something, and the Teamster gets on the radio and goes, yeah, I'll be right there. I got to drive some guy to the set. And my ego would be like, when I was an actor, I'm not some guy, you know what I mean?
I'm a success story.
But But as a director, I was like, I liked it. I was like, oh man, I'm just another guy on the bus. It made me really.
So you like that? You don't really miss acting?
No, but you know, now that I'm behind the camera, my idea of acting is completely changed. I think it's so much harder than I had given it credit for. You know, I was just doing this persona and that's kind of easy. I lock in and do it. But acting is so hard. I love actors now.
You have so much more of a respect for like,
oh my
God,
because they were just these people in the way of me getting laughs.
Yeah, right. They're listening. They're focused. And you're just going,
yeah,
Amy. Yeah, it's my turn.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it's completely changed. You know, when it doesn't look like they're working at all. You know, that's so awesome when you get that in a scene. It's so funny when I watch TV and in movies, and if they're not doing a good job. And I'm not trying, oh, I'm so talented, but I escape, you know, I'm out, you know.
That's what happens. I'm out.
And it's like,
I could be out. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's because if they're not, it's just because we love movies and TV and we also been in it. We know it. You know, my daughter and her boyfriend is a camera AC and he's sitting there going, you're soft. He's telling him to pull focus.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, cut, you know, one day. Back when I was directing Kimmel, I was exhausted. I'm watching Saturday Night Live, and I'm exhausted. And I'm there on the couch with my daughter, and it's during the music thing. And I just go, and I'm not ironic, not as a joke. I just go, camera three, like the shot was too long.
Oh,
I was
my God! Cut calling to camera three.
Yeah, I go camera three. Somebody else goes, Dad, go to bed. You know?
Did you feel like you had like a tough time in terms of making that transition? This persona and the squeaky guys, the voice, that
right.
Dude.
Well,
and now I'm going to direct things that will
right.
Matter.
Well, but so what happened was I directed Shakes the Clown and I didn't get any directing jobs for, you know, another 10 years. Between doing a talking horse movie and then an alcoholic clown movie that was like, this is how I see the world. And I'm not in the character in that movie. People think it's just this alcoholic clown movie. That put me in comedy jail and directing jail, and I didn't get any work probably for another 10 years, and I'm doing everything trying to direct. I'm trying to direct commercials, I'm trying to direct rock videos. No one's hiring me at all.
So what was the next thing?
It was Kimmel calling me up and saying, hey, you want to work on The Man Show as a director? And
with him and Carolla?
Yeah. And I was like, yeah. So I started directing, and that was like being an ER doctor. You know, sometimes there would be a film commercial, and then, you know, found comedy man on the street, and then, you know, just all these different genres. And I was directing them, and sometimes I'd be the only director. There was other directors, but sometimes there really was. I would have four editing bays going. And it was like me putting in that 10,000 hours they talk about. And, you know, Kimmel believed in me when my name really was a punchline. So he asked me to direct his TV show. And I go in and I see this live TV show. And And he goes, what do you think? And I was like, I think it'd be like landing a plane in Chinese. I don't know how to do it. And but I saw it and I realized that there was places where you could have cut to and that. And I knew that I, because of my friendship, I could have made it a little funnier. So I said, I think I could make it funnier. So, you know, hats off. That crew at Kimmel taught me how to do it, the cameraman.
And from there on, you started to get more work and more work. You were able to do things, on, you know, that you wanted to do.
Yeah, well, then during Kimmel, I'd written this movie. It was called Stay. And just because I had so many people turn down everything I wrote that I – and I was writing them for the wrong reasons. I was writing them for me to be in a movie. I was writing them because I thought I'd get made. I was writing them for other people, vehicles and stuff. And then I just – I said, I don't know if I can write a script and hand it to you and you can understand it because the reactions were so negative about everything I wrote. So I wrote this movie that wasn't for me to be in, and my manager at the time read it and had a meeting with his whole staff the next day, and they're going, this is a really well-written script, but we're frightened of your mental health. We don't want to send this out to people.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, and I didn't think it was funny. I was devastated. And I dropped that manager the next day because I said, right or wrong, this is what I want to be doing. So that just sat there for a year. I'm directing Kimmel. My friend, she reads the script. She says, this is a good script. We should make it. And we just shot it for $20,000 with a crew from Craigslist. And it got and it got into Sundance. And that kind of is how things started changing.
Wow.
Yeah. It was crazy. A crew from Craigslist and just like... We were filming one scene in this garage, and it's a pivotal scene. And I said to the crew, I was like, hey, you know, this is a scene, kind of a really heavy scene for the actors, so we have to be extra quiet and just be aware of that. And the cinematographer, Ian Takahashi, says, you don't have a permit again. I go, I don't know whose fucking house this is. We had broken in. I broke the lock off the door. We shot a scene. It was a house that was for sale and it was across the street.
Are you kidding?
No. So we filmed the scene in a home.
And no one ever said anything? You got your shit out of
there? It was even better than that because we're wrapping all the shit out and we're laughing that we pulled it off. And then a moving van pulls up for that house. It was so great.
Oh, my God. That's right out of a movie.
Yeah, but we did a lot of that kind of stuff. Even on World's Greatest Dad, there's a scene where I realized that Robin's character gets over his son's death too soon, and his son's a pervert. And so there's a scene where Robin's looking at a bunch of porn racks in, at a newsstand, and it reminds him of his son. He starts sobbing. So I called Chris, who's from Neuronica's. I was like, hey, we're in Seattle, and I'm making a movie. Would you be the newsstand guy? And he was like, well, what's the movie about? I go, well, you know when someone passes away, how people rewrite their history and they're kind of not concerned about the people that actually knew the person? He's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. So he was in the movie. But Robin's like, yeah, he shows up. And then I found out that he wasn't in Seattle at the time. He had actually flown in to do the part. But I said to Robin, I go, hey, man, we don't have a permit. Because it was like a scene that I came up with really quick and didn't have time to file it because you need like a week. And he's like, it's so Ed Wood. He's like, well, what do we do if people come? I go, run, you know. So there's a scene in the movie shot with Robin without permits. It's a pretty cool scene.
Wow.
Oh yeah.
You just have some balls. You just want to make your movie, man.
Yeah.
You still do that, or you get permits?
No. Sometimes it's still. That is a little funny. Like, do you know Bryce Johnson?
Mm-mm.
Oh, he's in a lot of the stuff I make. We shot Willow Creek, the Bigfoot movie, and we shot it up where the Patterson-Gimlin footage was shot. Actually, out of my reverence for the Patterson-Gimlin footage, I did not shoot on the actual location. I didn't want us trampling over it. Seriously.
Right.
So we shoot the movie, and we saw mountain lions. We saw two mountain lions. So it's 11-mile dirt road that takes about 2 hours to drive because it's just on the side of a mountain. And we get there, and we're shooting the scene. Like I said, we saw mountain lion, and in this scene, it's in this tent, and it's very intense. And we do the first take. It's an 18-minute-long scene. It's in the movie that long. It's no cuts, and it's just in the tent and a stationary camera. And so he says, so we do the first take, and he's just sobbing, and he's like, I go, this is really good. I don't think your character would cry though. And he goes, my character's not crying. I don't know why we're outside in a tent in the middle of the woods with no phone service. We could shoot this in the parking lot. And I was like, okay, that's good. Use that intensity. Just don't cry. Let's go again. It was just,
so he did another 18-minute scene.
Yeah, but he's like going, he's that's the one that's in the movie. But he was like, he was that, like you're saying, just getting it done. That movie was a little, I was a little bit, it's my Fitzcarraldo a little bit. Like I'm like lost in the woods. And I'm saying, they go, we just saw a mountain lion. I go, where? They go, over there. I go, let's film over there. And everyone's like going, let's get in the car. Let's go.
So it's when you're working for Bobcat, it's a little bit of an adventure.
Yeah.
You never know what's going to happen.
I mean, that was the worst case in that
right,
movie.
Right, right, right.
But then again, you know, I did ask Barry to go to those places. And I had Alexi Gilmore and Bryce in Willow Creek. I asked them to do very dangerous things. And in hindsight, now if I was on a regular, like a TV show or something that wasn't mine, those are the times where I go, let's slow way down, you know, even if we're behind, you know, cause that's when people get hurt when you're like trying to get effects.
And also when you feel like you're rushed, sometimes actors are like, oh my, I feel rushed here. You got to take that moment. You got to get.
Yeah, man. When I see an actor doing that, I'll do stuff like, I'll play music, but I'll take a ball out. I was like, hey, give me a ball. And I just start tossing it around with the crew. And we're
calm everything down.
Because we're behind, but I see this actor imploding, and I just take that 5 minutes where it looks like we got all the time in the world.
Yeah,
and
then you see that
and then you see that person do it.
That's happened, but where people are like, you can see the guy up there, the UP, what do they call him? The UPM.
Yeah, yeah. And you're fighting that all day
long.
We
got 10 minutes, but we got to go right now. And the actor's like, oh my God, I got to rush through this.
It's the worst thing to have in your head.
What's next for you?
Well, there's the Call Me Lucky narrative movie.
Call Me Lucky, you can find
on like iTunes. You know, I have a series that I did last year for True TV. I think that's on iTunes too, called Misfits and Monsters. Each week, a different kind of thing. And currently working on 2 movies.
And those are top secret?
No. I mean, you know, normally I tell my premises for movies because I figure, hey, if you can get it going, God bless.
Right.
But this one, I kind of am a little closed mouth. Like, because it's like, you know, I mean, like I wanted to do a zombie fetus movie called Ankle Biters, you know? It's just like, you know? And it's like, hey, man, if you can get it going, knock yourself out.
Hey, man, if you like that idea, let's get some more money over here.
Or it's like, I'll make more. You know, if someone does an idea, you know, it's not so, it's always going to be yours. I'll tell a story we get going on this, but I was at a meeting with a gentleman who I like, and he produces movies, and he's discussing the movies he has in development, and I'm discussing my ideas, and about a 2-hour meeting. And at the end of the meeting, he's like, well, there's this other thing. It might be too out there. And he goes, do you know who L'Epetomane is? And do you know who L'Epetomane is? Joseph Pujol. His name is means the fartest, and he was the highest paid entertainer in the Moulin Rouge in the turn of the last century because he could fart music and he did impressions out of his ass.
Sounds like a great artist.
Yeah, he was huge. So he goes, do you know who L'Epetomane is? And then I go, yeah, I know who L'Epetomane is.
Is that him on your arm?
Yeah, it's like a full sleeve.
You have a tattoo of that guy on your arm, yeah. The fartist?
Yeah, yeah. It says never forget. And it was the best.
That's an amazing tattoo.
Yeah, it's really good.
Holy shit.
Isn't it insane, though? Because he was like, have you ever heard of him? I go, yeah, I've heard of him. So
I've had him. He's on my arm.
Yeah. So ideally, I would love to, you know, maybe L'Epetomane will be a dream, you know.
That sounds like a
because
lot of fun
the movie, again, you're going to think it's this, but it's going to be about what is art. And this guy is tortured. You know, it should be like
tortured soul. And this is what he does. And he thinks that this is.
Well, he knows that people are laughing, but he knows he also has so much more to say. So I am L'Epetomane.
With his ass.
Well, no, but no, he's just stuck. He's tortured by this. So, to me, aww. I think it's myself, you know. So you know, but it'd be like Daniel Day-Lewis is L'Epetomane. I am L'Epetomane, God damn it. Flipping tables.
I love it. Well, this has been a real freaking treat, man.
Oh, good.
I didn't know. I mean, we didn't know each other other than we met at James Gunn's house a couple times. And I was like, I always like this guy. He's so interesting. He's done so much. I've had friends that worked with him. And this was better than I thought it would even be.
Oh, geez, thanks.
Because you're very open. You know, I could tell some things were a little dark for you, but you like you opened up as much as you know you could. And
yeah, I try to be honest. It's too. I'm over protecting myself.
I am too. So many years, I was just like, you know. I think that's the biggest compliment. People say you're just so. I know everything about you. I think I know you. You're so vulnerable. I'm like, good. Because that's the only way this works, is if you know, I'm being real. Bobcat, thank you for allowing me to be inside of you today.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.